Hello. Hello, good evening, Melbourne.
No.
No. Too kind.
Douglas rules that I just follow around the country. This is our last show, but it's brand new. We do a different show every night. It's great to be here in Melbourne. If you have a VIP wristband, one of the blue wristbands, and you didn't manage to meet Douglas before the show, then stay seated after the show when everyone else leaves and we'll take you to our secret lair. Ideally, no phones and cameras and things. People don't want to see you taking photos of us and videoing us. It's not us. It's just the rest of the crowd. It's been so fascinating. We've had so many different conversations. Douglas, one thing that I have not asked you about at the beginning of any show so far is you went to Israel as soon as you could after October 7th. Mm-hmm. Pretty much never left. You've been living in a hotel there ever since. What's it like? What's the mood?
Yes, I went as soon as I could after the 7th. I was in New York on the 7th, and I've been there ever since, until coming to this fair country. And the truth is that the mood has changed quite a lot. The initial impact, the 7th, ended up with a country in deep, deep trauma, which I'm not sure was understood very widely outside of Israel. And the trauma, if I could put my finger on it, was this, that I immediately went to the massacre sites, to the kibbutz, the communities that had been attacked on the 7th, and then and to the site of the Nova massacre and much more. And as I went around the hospitals and the morgues and spent a lot of time with the kidnapped families, what I found was that an enormous number of the parents had said to their children when they were hiding in their safe rooms, and some people might wonder, well, why did they have safe rooms? And why did they not lock? And the answer is that every house in the south, however poor, and some of these communities are very, very beautiful, places like Be'eri, near Oz, Kfar Az, they're like these sort of beautiful just villages of 400 or 1,000 people, sometimes the biggest ones. They all had safe rooms because rockets were a daily event. Everyone was used to getting rockets from Gaza. They had been since 2005. And so children in these communities, these villages, grow up with, a siren goes and you go to the safe room and you sit there until the all clear goes and then you go out and continue your day. But the rooms, although they shut, they don't lock, because nobody ever expected door-to-door terrorists. And an awful lot of parents that I spoke with said that they had said to their children on that terrible morning, don't worry, the IDF will be here in minutes. And they weren't. Some of those places stood alone for hours, almost a day, some of them, before the IDF were able to get in and make the all clear. And the result was a deep, deep trauma, which is ongoing inside Israel. And I wish there was more sympathy, empathy for outside the country, which is the trauma of thinking this is the one place in the world where Jews are allowed to defend themselves, and we're defenseless. You know, what I describe as the fauderization of Israeli society, the idea that doesn't just exist in Israel, but exists outside Israel in the diaspora and among non-Jews who just sort of, think everyone took the old boast that, they can't sneeze in Gaza without us knowing. And it turned out not to be true. And to give you one very quick example, rather ugly place to start, but nevertheless, war is ugly. There was a father I spoke with when I first got to Israel who was in the hospital, in one of the hospitals in Tel Aviv, and he had been in the safe room of their kibbutz, Beri, and he was there for hours with his 14-year-old son and 16-year-old daughter and his wife. And on the morning, as everyone else, they got the sirens came, so they went to the safe room. Then they started to hear the gunfire. And then they realized the gunmen were in their house. And the gunman couldn't open their door because the father was a big man. He could hold it shut. And I've spoken to lots of people who couldn't hold it shut. And he managed to hold it shut. So the terrorists of Hamas started set fire to the house. But he could already hear the screams of his neighbors. And he worked out, if we run out of the house, they'll just machine gun us. So he persuaded his whole family to sit in the house, and they covered their faces with towels. And then he couldn't bear it anymore. He thought, I'm going to burn alive with my family. But he said, I said to my son, don't worry, the IDF will be here in minutes. And they ended up opening a shutter, which a lot of the safe rooms have, just to, they were dying. And he opened the shutter to let some air in. And the Hamas noticed. And they threw a grenade in, which immediately killed his wife. And his daughter was hiding in the corner. And then a Kalashnikov came through the window. And they shot his son through both sides of the chest. He bled out in front of his father and sister. And his father said to me, the last thing his son said to him was, I'd like to be, he was a keen surfer. He said, I'd like to be buried with my surfboard. And he said, as we sat in the hospital, he said to me that the authorities had said to him the day before, you know, we found some of the remnants in your house. Is there anything you want? And he said, there's only one thing I want, if you can find my son's surfboard. And he buried him with it. But I had the opportunity to put this point to Prime Minister Netanyahu when I interviewed him the other month. I said to him, I've just spoken to so many survivors, and they all said the same thing. The IDF will be here in minutes. And they weren't. What went wrong? And the truth is, nobody really knows for sure what went wrong. But whatever it was that did go wrong, at the intelligence level, at the military level, whatever it was, that is a deep trauma for any society to go through, and particularly for that society. Because if there's one thing that was a lesson after the Second World War, it was that Jews had to be in charge of their own security, their own future. They had to look after themselves because the world could not be trusted to look after them. And that has held pretty much. Even 1973, it's held pretty much. I think something very, very deep happened on the 7th where people felt it's not held.
When you say that nobody knows why the IDF took so long, one theory about why the IDF took so long is that Benjamin Netanyahu's hard right government has spent the past 15 years building so many settlements in the West Bank that they require so much protection that the southern border was unprotected.
The southern border wasn't unprotected, but there was a congruence of events. One was that a lot of people went home for Simchat Torah, the religious holiday. Too many people were sent home from base, definitely. It's not the case that the IDF was distracted by the West Bank, although there is an argument, and that'll come out in the Commission of Inquiry, which I think will be brutal.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the IDF who ended up going there were going from the West Bank to there.
Well, some were, but most were all around the country with their families and elsewhere across the country. And, I mean, we'll find out. I've got some early feelings of what went wrong, but some ideas of it. But, I mean, fundamentally, there's what even the politicians have admitted publicly, and it's very hard for politicians, of course, as we all know, to admit anything has gone wrong. Because if they admit something's gone wrong on their watch, then they're culpable. You know, military leaders, intelligence leaders, they can admit it because they're in post. The minute a political leader says, I mucked up, you know, you're toast. I mean, that's all your political opponents will play is you saying, I'm sorry. You know? And although I tried to get Netanyahu to say that, he didn't, he wouldn't.
He doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who that comes easily to.
He's, yeah, I mean, it's a tough region, so it needs tough leaders. They don't have the luxury of...
He can be tough and humble.
I like to think so. but I mean, they don't have the
exhibit
luxury.
A.
They don't have the luxury that this country has of being having New Zealand as their nearest neighbour.
Not to quibble, but I think it's Papua New Guinea.
But not heavily armed, I think. I think that the one that the politicians will admit went wrong was that they had what they call the conception was wrong. And I've interviewed most of the people who are the masters of this conception. And the conception was, broadly speaking, that, and it was a historic, unbelievable error, that Hamas, although they were indeed violent, genocidal in their intent towards the Jewish state, were keen on remaining corrupt and enriching themselves and buying luxury apartments in Doha and so on, but that therefore this status quo wouldn't be disturbed, not by a really big event. And that turns out to be one of the most historic mistakes ever made by any government official.
So let's talk about the fallout, because I want to talk about here and what's going on in terms of public opinion. Mm-hmm. There's clearly been a shift in the wake of the catastrophe. There was, of course, some cohort of people who were sympathetic to Hamas and some cohort of anti-Semites who will always be irredeemably anti-Israel. And yet, nonetheless, over the course of the past 5 months, there's been a rise in sympathy for Palestinians, I would say, a rise in sympathy for people who question Zionism as a project and wonder whether the whole thing is a misbegotten venture. It's a war that's tailor-made for TikTok, 15-second images of babies in rubble. It's no picnic in Gaza. Is Israel losing the PR war?
The most important thing I always think with a war isn't to win the PR war, but to win the war. It matters a lot more. It's more important they win in Gaza than they win on TikTok. And
are you sure about that?
Pretty sure. Nobody dies yet because of TikTok, but they will die if the IDF stop the rockets.
The theory would be that for Israel to thrive over the course of the next century, it's going to be necessary for global public opinion to not regard it as a complete pariah.
That's absolutely true. And it mustn't be regarded as a complete pariah, but it's tricky because there are lots of countries trying to push them into being a pariah. Principally, of course, the Revolutionary Islamic Government in Iran, which is extremely clever in its global manipulation. I mean, the South African guy was in South Africa last week before, I can't remember.
But last week we were in Perth. That's different. South Africa has some similarities.
No, I remember the distinction because in Perth, the lights remained on. I remember that distinctly. I was in South Africa, and of course, you know, they had just taken Israel to the International Court for this absolutely fallacious claim of genocide. And they had done so clearly at the behest of the Iranian government. Immediately after the 7th of October, the foreign minister in South Africa flew to Tehran. And they just got a delegation back. And I said to their politicians, I didn't manage to see the ANC leadership. They were too busy lining their pockets. But I saw the heads of all the other parties. And I said to them, you know, your country has one very, very strong thing on the international stage, which is the moral capital of the defeat of apartheid and the peaceful resolution to that awful period. And I said to them, you should know that your government has sold your moral legacy very cheap to Tehran. And but you're right. I mean, there is a PR war, and it does matter. And I think that most people, you know, around the world, most people look at the news in the evening on their phone, pick up the paper if they still do, and they just see killing, and they say, I want the killing to stop. And that's completely understandable. I mean, everyone wants the killing to stop. But well, there is one thing I got to say, which strikes me very, very clearly about covering this war, which is that the year before this, I was in Ukraine with the Ukrainian armed forces as they were retaking territory from the Russians inside Ukraine. I went in, I was one of the first people into Kherson when it was taken back after 8 months of Russian occupation. And I was very, very upbeat about it at the time because they were making so many advances and it was just terrific, great momentum. And the one thing I noticed that nobody said to me when I returned, when I wrote about it, when I reported from there, nobody said to me, you know, maybe the Ukrainians should be more careful about civilian casualties. Maybe the Ukrainians shouldn't, you know, I mean, are you sure they're being okay with the Russians and, you know, and treating them well? And have they made sure their Russian opponents are fully fed and watered? And nobody said this. And in fact, I'd say more than that. Nobody said there must be a ceasefire. Everybody around the world said we want the Ukrainians to win. And with Israel, the world always says the same thing, which is they must fight to a draw. They must fight to equal. And I think that is one of the reasons this conflict has gone on all of our lives. It's because Israel is never allowed to win. And winning, among other things, means that you stop the precursor of the next conflict. Every conflict Israel has been involved in, particularly since the withdrawal from Gaza, is a 2 or 3 year cycle where Hamas once again do an extraordinary barrage of rockets and then Israel has to go in. This time, of course, a massive incursion, a 4,000 terrorist incursion into Israel. And of course, they had to go in.
But I mean, the difference, of course, with Ukraine is that people don't regard Ukraine as being complicit in the status quo that was untenable. People do regard
Israel
as being...
They do in Moscow.
Well, of course they do in Moscow, but we're talking about public opinion here in the West. I mean, if October 7th had happened in a context in which, instead of spending the previous 15 years aggressively expanding settlements in the West Bank and sort of being okay with Hamas being in Gaza as long as it splits the Palestinians and detonates any possibility of a two-state solution, if instead of that there'd been some framework for peace, for what the day after looks like in Israel, then would there be as much sympathy for anti-Zionism today?
I think there would be. I think there would be another reason.
It doesn't matter what
I think there would be another reason for it. I think it's a pathology. There's some things, you know, are too deep for political analysis. They come from a pathology. They need a psychiatrist to work it out.
But the Indian government was backing Israel on October 8th. You know, the Saudis were making all the right noises. Does the Indian government have an anti-Semitic pathology?
Perfectly possibly. They do their own business whenever they want to. My God. Same with all the countries that have fallen away. I mean, everyone does what they want. When terrorists attacked in Paris, when ISIS attacked Paris in 2015, 2016, the French government immediately started bombing Iraq along with my government and the American government, and nobody cared about civilian casualties in Mosul. Nobody cared. There was a job. Get rid of ISIS, destroy them, kill them. We can't live with these people. I believe it's the same with Hamas. They have to be destroyed. We can't live with these people. Everyone in Israel knows that, but the wider world doesn't. And I think there will always be a reason. There is a pathology about it. This isn't to say that there aren't all sorts of legitimate arguments and criticisms that can go on. I don't agree about the problem of settlements. I don't think that is the main problem. I don't think it's even a second-order issue.
It's just symptomatic of a worldview, which is that Israel should be Israel. As Smotrich Lahad, right, finance minister, said last week when he was allocating another 2,500 acres of the West Bank to settlements, he said Israel will be Israel, including Judea and Samaria.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, the fact is, and the international community doesn't always understand this, is that it is a very odd thing if the Jewish state exists right beside its historic homeland. I mean, it's a very Judea and Samaria are the places where the prophets walked. This is where they're buried. They're not buried in Tel Aviv, lovely city as it is. And so, of course, people feel the intense belonging to these areas. Now, of course, there were Palestinians in the areas as well. I spent lots of time living among them as well. And it's my conclusion that that is going to be the world's ugliest border, if it's ever a border. But it basically works as two states anyway, in my experience. I mean, the PA has their sort of corrupt entity, and they have all these ministry buildings all built by the Europeans, and they have their own police force and things, and they have their own areas, and then there is Jewish areas. And, you know, the one thing everyone knows is that the whole of the West Bank will not be given over to the Palestinians, principally because if you stand in the hills of the West Bank in the night, you can look over and you can see the lights of Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Ben-Gurion Airport, and there is no darn way any sensible Israeli can hand over territory which will be within rocket range of these three places.
No
way.
No, but no proposal would have a militarized border. The proposal would be that would be a no man's land, there'd be a demilitarized state on the other side.
But I remember when Gaza was meant to be demilitarized. You know, I remember when the South, I covered the 2006 Hezbollah Lebanon Israel war. And I remember the way that war finished was that Resolution 1701 was passed by the UN, and it said that the Hezbollah will not have any rockets south of the Litani River in Lebanon. And I was up there, I've been up there quite a lot in recent weeks where there's a lot of activity, and the Hezbollah have 160,000 missiles pointed at Israel. And the international community peacekeeps in the same way that UNRWA educates. And... I saw it the other day. They drive along the border. Hezbollah fired a barrage of 6 rockets into Israel, and the UN peacekeeping force did a U-turn and went back to their base. Yeah, that's your UN. And if anyone can tell me that any government in the world, the Israeli government, the Australian government, any government would put their security in the hands of an international force that doesn't peacekeep but just war watches. I've got a bridge to sell them, but they had this extraordinary. Just today I saw in the news, in Tel Aviv, between us, I can say this because we're in private, and as a friend of mine always says, I'm not indiscreet, but the people I talk to. but I can tell you, I live in a hotel with the residents of a place called Kiryat Shemona. A smallish town in the north of Israel, and all the residents were pulled out of their homes on the 7th of October by the IDF, and they haven't been back since. I've actually been to their homes more often than they have, and have been in Kiryat Shemona quite a lot. I saw that today Hezbollah fired 30 missiles at Kiryat Shemona today, and when you're there, because the Lebanon missiles are very advanced and they're much better than the Hamas ones, the rockets land and you hear boom, boom. And then there's a brief pause, and then the sirens go. In other words, this is even closer than the communities in the south. The sirens don't have time to pick up the rockets. Nobody can live in that place. And it's on the international community, not Israel. It was the international community that said that they would make sure that didn't happen. So it comes back to this fundamental thing. You know, I believe that all peoples, when they have an elected government, they're in a democracy like Israel, like Australia, like Britain, like America. The principal job of the government is to keep the people of your country safe. That's the number one thing. And that has to be your priority. Everything else down the line is a nice extra. But, you know, if Australia had been savagely attacked in a similar fashion and had by proportion of population lost, say, 10,000 people in a day, brutally murdered, raped, beheaded, and burned alive in their homes. And if you'd had about 1,000, 2,000 people stolen as hostages, I would expect the Australian government to tear up the earth to get the hostages back and revenge the attack.
Of course we would. And
well,
some...
I don't know if we would. There's a big question with every country other than Israel. The question is, would you actually do something? What would you do? But even if you did, who would you accept advice from who knew your security better than you?
Well, when I say, of course you would, I mean, of course it would be understandable if one had a mentality of grief and revenge after being attacked. When you look at the necessity of a government in safeguarding its citizens' lives, you need to look over the long term as well as the short term. So many of the Jews who, you know, around the world are ambivalent about what Israel is doing and feel frustrated or stuck. People like the most senior Jewish politician in history, Senator Chuck Schumer, who came out last week and called for elections in Israel and said that Bibi Netanyahu has failed to have a vision of a day after. What is the long-term plan? If you want to strategize about Israel being part of a community of nations that are in an alliance against Iran and Russia and maybe China, an alliance that could stretch from India through the Gulf Arab states, through North Africa, into the European Union and provide real solidarity, that alliance is not going to have a member who remains completely intransigent to resolving the issue that the people of the world seem to care about quite a lot.
So they're not intransigent about it. The problem is there's no partner for peace. If there's an election tomorrow in Gaza, Hamas will win again. And they were elected by the people. And I believe there's a cost to electing a terrorist group as your leadership. The West Bank Palestinians, whenever they're polled, and it's not changed much since the 7th of October, 75 to 80% of them say that they would vote Hamas tomorrow. And, you know, when people wonder why Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, is currently 18 years into his first four-year term, as I say, is a record that Vladimir Putin would admire. When people wonder why that is, it's because the world knows, and he knows, that if they had elections, he'd be turfed out. Hamas would come in and they'd chuck him off the top of a building or hang him like they did his colleagues in Fatah in Gaza in 2006. And in that situation, I understand the world's interest in it. What I don't understand, to use a term of conflict that's used only about Israel, is the disproportionality of the obsession. That I cannot understand. I do understand, but I think it has darker undertones. I think the obsession is unnatural. Again, nobody worries about whether President Zelensky has a day after plan for Ukraine. Nobody wondered what the allies who destroyed ISIS, or largely destroyed ISIS, nobody wondered what our day after plan was for Mosul. We didn't worry about death counts of civilians in Mosul, which were about 4 or 3 civilians for every one terrorist killed, as opposed to the IDF figures, which is roughly one terrorist to about 1.5 civilians, which is terrible, but war is terrible. But the obsession with this particular conflict, I believe it comes from a generational misunderstanding, which exists in this country, which exists in Britain, and exists in America, which is this lunacy of the idea that all the problems of the Middle East would be solved if only the Palestinians had another state. I say another state because they were given a state in 2005. Gaza was effectively a state. And they ruled it. And my God, did they misrule it. But the idea that another Palestinian state, say in the West Bank with an ugly carved out border somewhere, the idea that if that happened, all the other problems in the Middle East would be mitigated, I think, is for the fairies. The Yemen's economy is not suddenly going to be in the hands of great entrepreneurs the day after that. They're not going to stop hanging gays in Iran or giving women equal rights. None of this changes if there's another failed Arab state. And just to go back a step before that, again, it's the obsession about it that I find both fascinating and deeply worrying. I think there are explanations for it state by state. Countries like this, sometimes they just have a misunderstanding about this. They dream this stupid dream that if you solve the Palestinian-Israeli dispute, everyone else in the region would go home and have a happy life. And in Europe, there are different psychopathies at play, not least the deep desire of continental Europeans to be able to accuse the Jews of what they did to the Jews. I mean, wow.
Is that strong? You know,
if you can accuse the Jews, that's why they use the words they do. They say they're very, very specific. Nobody accuses the Ukrainians of genocide. Nobody accuses the Ukrainians of creating a Warsaw ghetto.
only, watch out for when those terms occur. They only occur in relation to the Jewish state. They say it because they want to wound Jews. That's my belief. They want to wound Jews, hurt them. They say things like they're behaving in a Nazi-like way. And the follow-on from that is that they deeply, they don't even, it's so deep they don't even know it. They want to be able to say, even the Jews have done it. So we can be absolved for the 20th century. Excellent. We can get going again.
I wonder if there's something else. Yeah. I wonder if there's also something else feeding in. I've been fascinated by my peers' reaction to October 7th and the amount of fatuous anti-Zionist nonsense, especially on social media. And I wonder if there's a kind of heuristic, a template that we all have, and by we all, I mean, I suppose I'm referring to my colleagues in the press who tend to be university educated, mostly white, mostly upper middle class elites who have absorbed a certain set of doctrines about what you're supposed to say about sexism and racism and colonialism and oppression and gender and whatever. And we all know this thought bubble, right? It's like, it's so bloody boring. And
totally predictable.
And so it provides a template where if you see a conflict and there's a white person who looks rich and is wearing a suit and has lots of bombs, and there's a person of color sitting amid rubble, of course your guilt, your post-colonial sympathy goes to the person in the rubble. We've sort of been trained that this is a template that we can superimpose onto all conflicts and onto everything. It tickles us. It makes us feel virtuous. It makes us feel like we're able to show other people that we're virtuous because we're on the right side of history. We're not on the side of the colonizers or whatever, the settlers. And it strikes me that that is just an off-the-shelf bit of bullshit that's being superimposed onto this conflict.
Yeah, I mean, there's no obvious reason why I can predict with 100% accuracy your views on the Middle East based on whether or not you should be able to mutilate the genitals of a child. And it's absolutely the case if, for instance, somebody says, I'm very big in supporting trans kids, I know exactly what their views on the Middle East are going to be. Absolutely. And why should that be? It's so strange. It's so strange. It's an a la carte political philosophy. And it believes, yes, you're right. I mean, this is a very, very deep one. Believes that all of the world can be divided into oppressor and oppressed, colonizer and colonized, victim and victimizer. And you just sort of, obviously sort of fell out of the heads of people in the American Academy. But that idea, which doesn't really work in America, is a horrible, horrible ideology. It doesn't really work in America. It doesn't work anywhere. And then they try to transplant it on the Middle East and see if it can work there. And, you know, the result of it is that you end up calling for the eradication of the Jewish state in the name of anti-Nazism.
No. I mean, when you say it doesn't work in the United States, how do you achieve civil rights and cultural progress without trying to undo the biases of the past? I mean, so taking this country, for example, it's not like everyone had a deep and abiding understanding of what had happened to the First Nations people in the 1950s here. So there needed to be a redress. Now, whether that is now becoming ridiculous because you've got four white middle-aged women on an HR Zoom call all doing their acknowledgements of country about the land of the traditional owners or something.
Who
is this helping?
Who is the traditional owner of Zoom, by the way?
I'm sure he's fabulously wealthy, but he's probably not an Indigenous Australian. You know, so you can argue about the ways that you do it. Do you really need to be told when the plane lands that, you know, the Qantas likes the traditional owners of the land? Nonetheless, there was also something broken. There was something wrong. We hadn't reckoned with the stolen generations. We hadn't reckoned with the way that First Nations people were treated. So isn't it necessary to counteract the hierarchy by the installation of a deconstruction of the hierarchy?
Oh, deconstruction. Such a hideous word. I'm deeply keen that after the era of deconstruction, we have a new era, which is the era of reconstruction.
and not just to tear down, but to build, not just to problematize, but to solve some darn things. You're right. I mean, what this points to, though, is that it's an incredibly difficult. I pointed this out in my book, The Madness of Crowds, a few years ago about all these weird sort of social justice movements that exist in our time. And I said there that I think what is going on, and the case you say of Australia is a good one, is always this tendency, which, considering how incredibly clever we should be and how connected we are and how much we have ability to knowledge and books and access to information and swapping knowledge, we're very bad at, which is how to correct a past injustice, perceived or real, without overcorrecting it. And in almost every context at the moment, what happens is an overcorrection. I mean, the most obvious one, which I wrote about in Matters of Crowds, was the overcorrection to do with relations between the sexes. When in 2017 the Me Too movement started, actually saw Ronan Farrow somewhere last summer. I was like, do you know what you did? I mean, on the one hand, yes, there were cases of men taking advantage of their positions of power, definitely. But the overcorrection, particularly in America, where it became like the people were losing their jobs and livelihoods for a bad pass, you know, or a bad date. There was a comedian.
Or a bad joke.
A bad joke, absolutely. Which is, as you know, is everyone's right to make.
I make a lot of them, Douglas. I make a lot of them.
I noted you're defensive on that one. God damn, we have the right to make bad jokes. But I mean, a bad pass. There was a comedian, Ansari, who lost his job because a girl described a date they'd been on. Nothing non-consensual had happened, but she just, you know, sort of looked back and didn't like it much. And
no one clapped at the Emmy Awards when he was nominated. Did you see that? Oh, they read out his name and the auditorium was silent.
Oh, they're such cowards. They're such cowards. It's like the fact that, you know, Kevin Spacey lost his career, was found not guilty of the crimes that he was accused of, and no one in Hollywood wants to touch him still. I mean, they're such cowards. It's all about patting themselves on the back for their bravery. You'd never meet anyone more callow than a Hollywood producer. But no, I mean, they had this, by the way, if you're going to reconstruct sexual norms, I've always thought that Hollywood is a bad place to base that on. I mean, the town that literally came up with the term casting couch came up with it for a reason. But it was amazing that that year after Me Too started, there was a perfectly reasonable place to take it, which was like, you know, Harvey Weinstein-like people should not be allowed to get away with their behavior. There's no reason why, you know, they ended up with a situation that, I mean, effectively, the way I said is that if you're not allowed to make a bad pass as a man, you're allowed one pass in your life, and it's got to be a bullseye. You have got to hit it right first time, one shot, and it has to be your partner for life. Good luck, boys. Now, that is, of course, completely unreasonable, but that was a massive overcorrection. And you heard people during that era saying all this stuff like, believe all women. Now, there's no more reason to say believe all women than to say believe all men, or believe all people who are 5'10". Why? Why? People lie, people fib, people exaggerate, people regret, people do all sorts of things. But that's an example of a culture where we cannot seem to not overcorrect.
I mean, overcorrection is actually a too generous term for it in some ways, I think.
Oh, good. I'm always pleased when I'm too generous.
Excellent. There's something else going on, which is that there's a rise in sort of virtue signaling about one's bona fides as a spokesperson for your own identity.
Yeah.
So if the overcorrection was just that we were all becoming too much like Martin Luther King Jr., or putting too much emphasis on a point of view about, I'm just taking race as an example, that even President Barack Obama, as recently as when he was present, it was pretty uncontroversial to say that you should treat each other on the basis of the content of your character and not the color of your skin. That is now regarded as a bit passé, a bit naive. You're only ever going to overcome structural inequality by pitting identity groups against each other. The LGBTQIA+, I'm sure I've left one out, community. And so if it was just a matter of overcorrecting, I'd be less worried about it. I'm more worried about it because it seems a bit like veering off into a different thing, which is actually anti-egalitarian.
Well, it's not just anti-egalitarian. It's so darn boring. I mean, I mean, being gay myself, I'm so bored of gay stuff. I mean, just give me a break. You know, like, I mean, a few years ago, my bank in the... I've got to be careful about saying this these days because you can be debanked, but... A bank that I bank with did this thing for Pride Month. Ah, Jesus. I mean, it's, of course, Pride Parade became Pride Day, became Pride Week, became Pride Month. We're very lucky not to have Pride all year round. But the bank had a massive redesign of its logo and it in the big rainbow flag, and it's Barclays, Love Happens Here. And apart from wanting to throw up, you know, I said at the time, I wrote a piece about this, but I said, the thing is, I bank with Barclays. I don't want love to happen there. I don't even want a quickie. I just want them to have real people behind the tills. And also occasionally have a branch that's actually open. And whenever I lose my statements, I don't want them to charge me £5. And I'd feel that was an expression of kindness by Barclays. But it's all this. It's all the overdoing it crap. It's, you know, it's the thing of, you know, you never see a policeman unless it's Mardi Gras. You know, if you there's an old lady who's been coshed over the head by a mugger, you can't find a policeman. And the sort of best thing to do is find someone doing the Macarena. They're just not interested in their real job. They just massively overcorrect. It's the same with the army. I mean, they do this fantastically in America. I live in New York most of the time. They're so bad in the overcorrection department. You know, you could say that, like, it's not a typical organization. The CIA, whenever it wants, you know, is doing a recruitment drive now. You might say that in the past there were times when the CIA didn't have the most equal hiring. It's not the biggest problem for a country. I don't think anyone says, I want to make sure that all my spies are exactly representative of every sexual kink. But as it happens, that's one thing the CIA did fulfill rather successfully.
Right up to the very top.
Absolutely. And but, you know, they did this one recent recruitment drive for the CIA, and they had this woman who... She's a lady of color, and she's on the big side, and she is walking through the halls of the CIA, and she's saying, you know, I am, and she identifies all the things she is, and it's just a whole list of conditions, and one of them is bipolar, and you know, I'm proud of her mental health things, and I thought, well, I hope she's not in charge of the drone program. Because if there's one thing I'm keen on, it's that the drones are in the hands of pretty mentally sick people. I do not want a manic depressive with access to the nuclear codes. But they did it to kind of show the CIA can be for you as well. And I just think that's preposterous. It's the same thing with the army. The Army of Britain does these recruitment videos. I mean, now if you're white and male and young and fit, you're the last person the British Army wants. I mean, you know, if you're a sort of pacifist, vegan, transsexual, you know, you get fast-tracked. Get your own drone in no time. And it's preposterous. And it's all just a massive overcorrection. You just want some adult to come along and just say, now, stop it right there. Stop it right there. There's going to be no more rainbow crossings. We just want to be able to walk across the road and not get run over. That's it. We don't want, like, a pride death. And no one seems to be able to do it. It's like the only adults, I mean, occasionally adults crop up. Some friends of mine in Paris some years ago, when Me Too was going too far, signed a wonderful letter, some actresses and philosophers and everything. God damn, I love French people sometimes. sometimes. They signed 100 women, prominent women in French society, signed a letter saying all this stuff from America is too much. They said, we like men flirting with us, and we like relations between the sexes, and we rather think they should go on. And everyone in France pretty much agreed. You know, they like a bit of nookie.
I mean,
and it was important for somebody to say that. But it's so striking that what these French women all said that was so obvious was not said by any woman in Hollywood or in politics in America. It wasn't said by anyone prominent in any other country, so far as I know. Certainly not in the English-speaking world.
Aren't the grown-ups in the room really, ideally, supposed to involve the media as well? I mean, this is maybe just me speaking from my own personal experience. I was an ABC radio personality in Sydney for the past couple of years.
What happened with that?
That's a long story, Douglas.
Okay.
But one of the things that I noticed when I got, one of the first things that I saw on the official ABC News Instagram feed in January, in the new year, I thought I'll check in, see what's been going on. I'd been abroad. And there was a big 9-page feature, one of these big magazine-style features that the digital department, news department does, that takes a lot of resources and is really meant to relate to people.
That's the issue on everyone's lips.
And it was about... Now, God bless this guy who they were profiling, but, you know, he was like, I'm a farmer, I'm out on the land, but I was born as a woman or I was assigned female at birth, as you're supposed to say. And now there's a lack of resources or knowledge amongst regional doctors for dealing with menopause amongst transgender men. And I was like, is this the most important thing that we need a 9-page feature on? And if it's not, what's happening? We're trying to signal to each other that we're in the club, that we've got the memo, that we're on the right side of history, that we like the underdog.
Yeah.
In other words, it's a sort of a social justice dogma mission instead of news reporting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's an explanation for this that Peter Thiel gave a few years ago. He said that he thought that maybe as the salaries in media declined in this century, the media started to pay themselves in a different currency. Now, what's the currency? It's the admiration and respect of your peers. So, you know, I'm at the Washington Post fighting for democracy because democracy dies in darkness. Turns out democracy can die at the Washington Post quite easily. but there's something very interesting in this. Because if a profession is paying less and less, and the people going into it, of course, end up being significantly people who can sustain themselves, that's another thing. So you get a self-supporting sort of class of trust fund babies and so on, and then they pay themselves in endless awards about their own courage. I've never known a profession which gives itself more awards for courage. Firemen don't do it all the time, and nor do policemen. It's the media that's forever slapping itself on the back.
And actors.
Oh, actors, of course. But I think the really interesting thing is why this is happening. And my conclusion has been for some years that since the 2008 banking crisis, when a form of basically, if you're a young person, it became very hard to accrue capital. And very hard to get on the housing ladder in all of our countries. And as a result, I believe that after 2008, politicians in the West, broadly speaking, said, let them eat identity politics. That was the Antoinette-ish invitation. We can't improve your lives in a material sense. We don't really know how to. We know China's eating our lunch. We know that we seem to be not doing all that well. Let's give the public some easy fodder. Let's pretend that there are massive issues which we still need to address, all of which, by the way, almost all of which are ones that have been addressed before. I mean, the discussion in this country, obviously I'm only a guest in your country, so I have to be careful what I say, but the discussion in this country, whenever it comes up about the Aboriginal questions, all my life, Australian politicians have apologized for this. I mean, I mentioned some of this in The Strange Death of Europe, but I mean,
you know, the sea of hands and the sorry books and things were the late 90s and the early 2000s. Kevin Rudd did a full-on apology.
Well, yeah, the official one was 2008.
Right, and like how many, just how many times are you meant to do it? It's like in Britain at the moment, one of the things that is a little noted but sad thing is that no minor member of the royal family can go anywhere without being urged in the world to apologize for slavery and indeed pay some money. Some of the local shakedown artists disagree about whether Prince Edward should actually just hand over the cash himself or not. But what always happens with it is that these people say the British royal family hasn't apologized for slavery or Britain hasn't apologized for slavery. And I always just go, we did. You just don't know. There's a difference between your ignorance and reality. You know, King George III signed the Anti-Slavery Act into law in 1808. My country has more than paid its debt over slavery. And yet a new generation of people come along, they say, no, you haven't yet made compensation for it. You just don't know that throughout the 19th century, every household in Britain had paid more in goods because we would not deal with and trade with slaving nations. And this was in an era where an average man in the north of England working in a mill died at 37 and started work at about eight, the age of about eight. And our sailors sailed the high seas for 60 years, policing the world to stop the slave trade and to stop Brazil, for instance, which kept slaving into the 1880s. None of the people who come along today know a single bit of this history. They don't know the young men who sailed around the seas and lost their lives very often. Thousands of them lost their lives getting onto slaving ships and saving the crew. And in fact, at Queen Victoria's Jubilee in 1900, there were thousands of people there, black freed slaves, who were waving the flags of Britain, saying, "We were freed by the Queen." Nobody in the
Is it because of the inheritance of American culture? Is it
absolutely.
All downstream of America these days?
All of us. I notice it in this country with a lot of your media. I mean, it's the same as in the UK. It's as if anything that happens in America happens here. You know, they catch a cold and we get the flu. And of course, I mean, that's why all these movements of recent years have happened.
I mean, what's so incredible about the slavery thing in particular is that the self-certainty with which people assert that they would have known what the right thing to do was if they'd been alive and that they would have had the courage to do it as well, as if there was something uniquely pernicious about the people back then in their time doing abominable things that everybody thought were okay. Like, my general take when people are quite sanctimonious about how they would have behaved in the past is to say, you show me an issue right now on which you're completely outside of the mainstream and are taking a wildly brave and courageous moral position that's so extreme you seem wackadoodle to everybody else, but is so perceptive that you'll be proven right in 100 years, and then I'll believe that you would have opposed slavery in the 1700s.
Yeah.
But if all of your views just happen to align with precisely the social justice dogma that all of your peers believe, of course you wouldn't have opposed slavery because you're a conformist.
Absolutely. Most people are. Well said. Yeah, I mean, most people are conformists. It's always been the problem of the moderns, that they think that they know better than Plato because they lived after him. That's preposterous. But just very quickly, I mean, and the amazing thing about this is, of course, they have this 2020 vision in the rearview mirror, and they would have been anti-slavery in the 18th century. They'd have been urging that women should have the vote in the 19th century and been arguing for gay marriage in the 17th century. And I don't think any of that's true. I think they'd have all been exactly like everyone else around them. Most people did not have the courage of a William Wilberforce. You know, these remarkable Christian people in England who argued against slavery because it was a moral obscenity. And that was how we banned it. A few remarkable people, but they weren't the norm at all. And as you say, most people who think they know exactly what they would do, well, Milan Kundera has this lovely line in Testaments Betrayed, the great Czech writer, he said, man walks in a fog and stumbles along a path and creates a path as he walks it. So that's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing is that when we look back, we see the man and we see the path, but we don't see the fog. It all looks so obvious after it's happened. Mm.
Thank you for uploading questions on that web, on the app slide. It was better than having people come up and ask questions and drone on for 7 minutes, isn't it, Adam, my friend? One person says, as a member of a so-called minority, you have benefited from progressive movements. As a conservative, how do you judge which progressive movements have merit?
That's a very good question. I believe that rights...
To hear the rest of this conversation, go to uncomfortableconversations.substack.com/listen and you will get your own personal premium podcast feed with at least 3 extra episodes of the podcast every month and heaps of extra stuff, including the remainder right now of the fabulous conversation you've just been hearing. If it was worth listening to this much of, don't rob yourself of the rest. Pull out your phone right now and search for Uncomfortable Conversations on Substack.